news, reviews, commentary, not just another podcast.
I'm the Ordinary Baseball Broadcast.
Now here comes your host, Kyle Abaron of the World Team.
Welcome to the Big Ball Broadcast, episode 135. All the geeky news you can use, part of thegeekmedia.com, streaming our endless ramblings live on StickCam each Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Hello, chat room. And if you miss an episode, you can always catch any of our previous ones, all thanks to the super-duper convenient archive page. Thank you, engineer. At thebigballbroadcast.com, my name is Kyle Abaron, anime and video game voice actor, podcasting from the West Coast.
And your co-host from the East Coast, LOL Steve. I'm a musician with Perimeter of the Void and a very rich music mogul with EBRecords.com.
You're rich? Can you throw me some money, dude? Because I'm broke.
That's kind of a joke, because I'm broke, too.
Oh, man! Okay, fine. Well, we both have stories to contribute here, that some of which are pulled from our Facebook page. Like, I completely raked our Facebook page and got these stories. Actually, Mark found these stories and posted them. Mark, our illustrious engineer. Kudos to you, sir. U.S. Airways thwarts possible terrorist threat from an Xbox. Dun, dun, dun. Is James Cameron's Avatar killing people? The band OK Go explains the conundrum of not making their YouTube videos embeddable on your blog. YouTube going flashless. Sarcasm punctuation mark aims to put an end to email confusion. Digital music prices, are they illegally fixed? All this and more ramblings here on the Big Bald Broadcast. So, Steve, to kick off the show, we have no email, so let's kill some time, shall we?
Sure, indeed. Indubitably.
Now, before we hit record, actually before Mark hit record, you have a conundrum of your own right now with your Xbox controllers.
I do, and I'm going to kind of plead to our chat room here and anybody listening to this in post. I have a little problem with my 360 controllers. They're rechargeable type, and I have it plugged in, and I'm playing with it plugged in, and anytime I unplug it, the Xbox is freaking out. It's like, please plug your controller back in. So what the hell's up with that? You know, they're rechargeable controllers that are not recharging.
And what is the amendment to this? Because you know what? You're going to hear a lot of people go, just buy a new rechargeable battery.
I don't want to spend money that I don't have.
Do you realize that if you didn't buy two packs of cigarettes, you could have a brand new rechargeable battery pack?
Two packs of cigarettes, three cups of coffee, and miscellaneous unmentionables. But we have a donate link on the website.
We do. We can donate to it. Yeah, we can donate to the Skype, not the Skype, the PayPal. There's a PayPal link on thebigballbroadcast.com. And speaking of new cool things, visit thebigballbroadcast.com if you feel like throwing us even a dollar. I mean, come on. If every one of our listeners gave us a dollar, then we'd all fight about how much money we get. No, but seriously, it'd be cool. Because we all do this for free. You know, Mark spends a lot of time editing and putting together things and working and slaving to make our awesome new archive page, which features all 134 or 135 episodes, easily clickable with a link all on one page. We also have a brand new talkback page. That means you can throw us your comments without even sending mail to mail@thebigballbroadcast.com. Although we still want you to, because feedback's a good thing. Of course, we have our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and search The Big Ball Broadcast. I found out before we started that we can't have a simple dedicated URL of facebook.com/bigballbroadcast. So don't bother entering that. That'll take you nowhere. Or there is a dedicated link page on thebigballbroadcast.com. And this is good. Also, there's a Twitter widget too, which Mark and myself update daily with geeky news links.
Way to throw me into the bus, Abar.
Oh, you update too? I didn't know that. I thought that was all.
No, I don't.
It's not really throwing you under the bus. You show up here every week. You do your part.
I do my part. I generally have my show prep done and whatnot.
That's more than I can say.
That's true.
I did do my show prep today, though. I'm very proud of myself.
You had it done before me by about a half hour, so congrats.
It took a while, though, because the OK Go story is a really, really, really long letter that the lead singer wrote, and we're going to talk about that after a while here, about embeddable videos on YouTube and all this fun stuff. Raizudo in our chat room, did you see what he said? He addressed something about the battery thing, something about resyncing.
I'm going to have to give it a shot, because it pains me that I can't play Bayonetta while I'm doing the show.
Now, Bayonetta, that's the camel toe boob version of Devil May Cry.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's boobalicious.
Okay. Now, people said that Heavenly Sword was God of War with boobs, and people prefer God of War. So if you're playing this, which is Devil May Cry with boobs, is Devil May Cry better or is Bayonetta better?
Devil May Cry has a kind of a sordid history with me because the first one, I wasn't really that much a fan. I liked the second one, even though people didn't really like the second one. And I really didn't play the third one too much, and I've kind of, you know, lost interest. But I don't know. I bought Bayonetta because I'm bored. It got phenomenal reviews, particularly on IGN. I'll be the first to say it didn't deserve those glowing reviews. It's not a 9.6 game. It's maybe a 7, but it's got boobies. So I guess that made it a 9. and like I was talking about before we started recording, interchangeable costumes, you know, that make it more boobalicious. And I'm just OCD. I can't put it down. There's achievements to unlock. So that's what I'm working on now. So I'm watching jiggling boobies in a nice, firmly sculpted buttocks area and just being an achievement whore until God of War 3 comes out in March.
You know, maybe it's the glasses that throw me off, but I look at that chick and I go, what the hell is Sarah Palin doing in a video game?
Come on, Kyle. Chicks with glasses are hot. Sarah Palin, Tina Fey, you know, there's something about that. Hotties with the glasses. It's so much more sexy with the glasses.
So you like the corporate librarian, conservative, but not really conservative?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like behind closed doors, this total freak. Hell yeah.
Okay, well, now we know because what your tasted women are.
Well, let's face it, you talk about games like, and I know they're not real boobs, as somebody in the chat so kindly pointed out to me, but you used to play in these very masculine games. You're playing God of War, you're Kratos, dude's running around in a loincloth, you know, so I got to play 30 hours of watching this muscular dude in a loincloth. Does nothing for me. I'd rather play a game with a heroine in the lead, because at least that is more appealing to me than some half-naked dude on the screen all that time. So I don't think it's really sexist. I think it's a little more appealing for the male gamer, a little more enjoyable. Plus, pixels can't get pregnant.
That's going to be a new shirt, isn't it? I can see it now. It's going to be a new catchphrase.
That's already guaranteed. It's absolutely guaranteed.
Nice.
Mark's got it in the beta stage, and we'll be rolling that out pretty soon. That's a tribute to me.
Ah, all right. Have you caught any new TV shows or movies or anything?
No.
He's been playing with Booty Bayonetta.
Yeah, okay. I think I mentioned this before. I've been enjoying Pawn Stars on the History Channel. I find the show fascinating. It's a pawn shop over in Las Vegas, and it's such a typical pawn shop. I mean, people from all over come into this place, and they've purchased you know, some incredible historic documents and old weapons and stuff. I like the historical aspect. People come in with this item, and you know, they'll bring an expert in and explain the history. And I'm a wicked history buff, so I kind of get off on that. So that's what I've been watching mainly. Watch a lot of the not sci-fi, but Science Channel stuff and educational stuff. There was actually a show on, I always forget the guy's name, the Asian doctor, professor, theoretical physicist dude, and they did a special on, if you were going to make a lightsaber, how would you make one and have it actually work? Because you can't use lasers, because lasers cross each other and then go on for infinity. It was really interesting to have a very, very, very serious scientific discussion on what it would take to create a lightsaber. And they keep using the word lightsaber, so they must have got the okay from Lucas to discuss that.
True that. I checked out this new show on Fox called Human Target, which is based on a DC Comics line, and I'm just reading the plot line off IMDb because it's probably better at describing it than I am. The cases of a unique bodyguard / private detective who interferes with murder attempts by impersonating the intended victims / targets to draw the killer's fire. This is like a 2-hour action movie cram-packed into an hour, and yeah, it's cheesy and over the top, but it's a lot of fun. So I would suggest going to Fox on Demand, you know, Fox's website, and catching up. really good stuff. And if you're a fan of Jackie Earle Haley, who played Rorschach on Watchmen, he's got a great role in this show. He's not the lead, but he's this hacker named Guerrero, who's like just this short kind of creepy looking dude who like really knows his shit. And he's like, he's really good in this. So highly recommended on Fox, Human Target. That's what I got for you.
And you know what I've been watching during the day, just for the sheer hilarity of it all? I hate reality shows, and I hate reality shows that deal with celebrities. That's like the worst kind of fodder that's out there. But whatever show, whatever channel it's on, MTV, VH1, I don't know. But this Celebrity Rehab thing, it's freaking hilarious. Oh, my God. I laugh my ass off every time that show is on.
I saw some this morning with Tom Sizemore.
Yeah. These people are so ridiculous. I don't know what's worse, having a drug or alcohol addiction or allowing yourself to be filmed while you're going through drug and alcohol withdrawals. It is a train wreck of just like magnificence. There's no other way to put it. It is so horrible. You can't look away. And Sizemore ends up going there and he was banging Heidi Fleiss and it's like, holy, what do you mean Heidi's here? And oh, drama, blah, blah, blah. I actually had a problem though with the bass player from Alice in Chains, because yeah. The dude's a spaz. I mean, he's a wreck. He's an absolute wreck. And my heart kind of goes out to him, but he's talking about, Layne Staley. And he was actually talking to Sizemore about that. And he's like, yeah, I knew Layne and he was a really good guy. And he's like, oh yeah, you know, another day goes by. I don't think about him. Okay. The dude died from a drug overdose. What made you think it was okay for you to develop a drug habit? You know, it's like you're talking about your friend that's gone because of the issue you have. Come on. It's rather hypocritical.
Yeah. I guess your brain will explode if you think about it too much, because these celebrities that are kind of washed up, how are they going to get back and get 15 minutes of fame again? Oh, okay, a rehab show. So do we have to pay you, or do we just give you this free exposure on this show? But that'd be kind of sad. It's like, we'll pay you to go to rehab. You don't really have to go. Just come here and throw a tantrum, and we'll pay you. And then you get exposure. Everybody wins.
Well, it's funny when Sizemore finally decided to come in and the camera crew is out there and he starts freaking out. He's like, oh, you called the press. I effing hate the press, blah, blah, blah. And the doctor's explaining, well, it's not the press. And all of a sudden he like calmed right down like, oh, this isn't the press. This is for the show. And I'm like the star in the show because I'm a whacked out meth head.
Yeah, really. God. Yeah, I have to admit that, you know, the train wreck that is Celebrity Rehab and then the sex rehab, too. I mean, have you seen that one?
Ooh. I haven't, but that sounds pretty interesting. Who's in that? David Duchovny and Tiger Woods?
Oh, give it time. Give it time. You know they're going to be development deals for that.
I don't know. You know, I was talking to some of my coworkers about the whole sex addiction thing. And, you know, last year, the year before, David Duchovny entered sex therapy because he's a sex addict. And now Tiger Woods is, you know, in sex therapy. And it's like the reality is if you're a guy, particularly like in America, yeah, you're a sex addict. There's no therapy that's going to help you from that. What are they going to do? You know, you're going to go to a clinic and they're going to make you gay or something, because there's nothing that's going to change that. You're going to leave there and still be, ooh, boobies, you know? So I don't understand the therapy behind being a sex addict.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the guys who aren't sex addicts are just channeling that the hormones into something else. It's like, I went and built a bridge, or I wrote a concept album, or whatever. It's like, oh, okay, so you didn't jerk off, or you didn't get laid.
It's this justification thing, you know? It's like, you know, you're in the entertainment industry, you have an agent. If you were to do something stupid, to say something stupid online, or, you know, get in a DUI or whatever, what's the first thing you do? You enter treatment, you know, that fixes everything. It fixes your reputation. Well, you know, I went into treatment, so I'm going to be all better. I don't think the same thing applies to quote unquote sex addiction. Your infidelities aren't going to be fixed because you claim you have an addiction. You wanted to go tap another ass. It happens, you know, but because you're a celebrity, oh, I'm a sex addict and I need help. No, good on you. You know, the New York Post published a calendar, a 12-month calendar with a picture for each month of the girls that Tiger Woods was betting. And we have it hanging up at work. It's like the greatest centerpiece we have near my office. It's like, how would you even want therapy for that? I'm applauding the dude for that.
Well, now that we've gone totally way off course, I guess we'll take a quick break and come back and talk geek stuff. So coming up on the Big Ball Broadcast, we're going to talk about James Cameron's Avatar and its effect on the movie going public. And we're not talking about reviews either. We're talking about an Xbox that got a special treatment from U.S. Airways. We're going to talk about digital music prices. Are they being fixed illegally? What? Can the comments you make on social media actually affect your credit? OK Go is going to talk about their conundrum with making their videos on YouTube embeddable on your blog. Sounds simple, but it kind of goes deeper than that. All of this and more coming up on the Big Ball Broadcast.
Weebertainment Weekly, the greatest podcast you'll ever find, starring Tombstone and Zach Jenkins.
Sure, there are better ones out there, but not starring them.
This is Tombstone from Weebertainment Weekly, and this is the opportunity for me to shamelessly promote my program.
You mean our program, right?
Yes, Zach Jenkins, I mean our program. You are technically the host.
Since you've taken over being the spokesman for our program, why don't you tell them what we have?
On Weebertainment Weekly, you'll hear the best in entertainment and media news, as well as my favorite section, Talk Nerdy to Me, where I make fun of guys like Zach Jenkins, who wish their girlfriends look like anime characters.
Your mom. Join us every Tuesday night from 7 to 8 on WeberFM.org. Or you can join us on our podcast at WeberTainmentWeekly.blogspot.com or on iTunes under WeberTainment Weekly.
It's an honest podcast. I believe when he says, I don't do this because I'm a voice actor, I do this because I'm a fan. But at the same time, acknowledge the fact that there might be a bias there.
It's a knowledgeable podcast. But it wasn't until after Pokemon kind of blew up over here that they actually brought Sailor Moon back for a second round. But I don't think Sailor Moon was ever as popular here the second time around with S and Super S. I don't think it got to the magnitude of popularity that it was here.
It's an opinionated podcast.
I fucking hate this adaptation of Death Note.
It's an emotional podcast.
Yay! No! Okay, it's alright.
It's an odd podcast.
The greatest move ever to destroy the Wandering Warrior was to hit him with a semi. We're not even joking.
It's an amazing podcast. An amazing podcast every second Wednesday on iTunes and Earth2.net. Earth-number2.net.
Hey there, hey there, oh there, warning. The following promo may contain some profanity like fuck, shit, fuck, ass, bitch, and mother. If you're offended by any of the previously mentioned words, well, then you're sure not gonna like this next segment.
Yeah, so here's some clips from Deadly Loofah Radio. Enjoy the clusterfuck.
I got damn purpley purpleys, and I'd like to advise everyone, they do not taste like purples.
The tire wasn't in the trunk. I was sitting there literally holding the fucking tire.
Oh, they caught him stealing rims.
That's
Ace. Is it working?
Yeah, I think so.
Is that why my crotch is just like hell?
Merry Christmas!
Oh, God!
Wait a minute. So the story just went from you guys in the back of the cop car to Roxy's crotch. Yeah,
Welcome to DLR.
Well, your mom's gonna hear about this later. I am so fucked.
Yeah, it's that stupid. Yeah, check us out on iTunes. Just search Deadly Loofah Radio. Or check us out on Stick'em as well, stick'em.com/deadlyloofah. We're there, we promise.
Those were the beeps. I must be Brett Weaver, and you're listening to the Big Bald Broadcast. Listen to it, love it, know it. Oh, yeah.
We love Brett Weaver, yes we do.
Okay, welcome back to the Big Ball Broadcast, episode 135, giving you all the geeky news you can use from the West Coast, the East Coast, and beyond. I don't know really what the lead story here. What should we talk about, Steve? Let's just talk about it live on the air here instead of having a plan.
I think most people have figured out now we don't have a plan going into the podcast. You know what? Let's just talk about the first story that I have, since I have a few more news items than you. Let's talk about the Sark Mark. Very well planned, intended. Dig it, Kyle.
Yeah, it worked.
How's that sound?
That sounds great.
Yay! A U.S. firm has come up with an ingenious solution to this very real problem. A new item of punctuation. The Sark mark, as it has been named, is designed to be used in the same way as an exclamation or question mark. Anyone concerned that the irony of their email or text message might not be appreciated by its recipient can use the symbol to close their sentence, thereby avoiding awkward misunderstandings. The symbol, a dot inside a spiral line, can be installed onto any PC running Windows 7, XP, or Vista, as well as Macs and BlackBerry mobile devices. It can be used in Word documents, instant messaging conversations, Outlook email, and other programs just by pressing Control and the full stop button. The Michigan company behind the Sark mark have applied for a patent to protect their invention. They have even published a sample list of sentences that would benefit from the Sark mark, including the words of a British woman who was awarded only half of her national lottery jackpot by a court after the winning ticket fell from her pocket and was claimed by someone else. It appears that the irony of her statement, quote, "It's jolly decent of them to let me have half of the share of my win," was lost in some readers. Paul Sack of the firm said that the new punctuation mark was not a gimmick and had serious potential applications, such as allowing deaf people to pick up on sarcasm in subtitles. The symbol currently costs $1.99 to download, a price that many think deserves a Sark mark of its own. And I dig it. I certainly dig it because I got in some trouble at work relatively recently where I did kind of throw a sarcastic line in an email to one of my superiors. They got kind of blasted for it. I think emails, text, because we're very, you know, texty now and with Twitter and Facebook and everything, I think sometimes it's really easy to misconstrue somebody's intent because you lose that inflection of speaking to somebody when you're reading text. It's really easy to take it out of context. So I think the addition of a new punctuation mark, the Sark mark, to indicate sarcasm, I think it's been a long time coming. I don't know if it's going to be generally accepted, but I kind of dig the idea.
I am all for a Sark mark. My God, this would clear up so much confusion and stop so many arguments and potential firing situations. You know, like with an email, it's like, well, I couldn't tell if you had a, you know, and emoticons aren't enough. Sometimes the smiley isn't enough to just put a smiley on there. I mean, maybe you were sarcastic with the line, and it's like, I don't know. Is there a sarcastic smiley? I don't know. And if there is, it doesn't work. So if we can make a punctuation mark that can do this, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said this firm is charging for the use of this mark, $2 a pop?
$2 to download the font, I guess, to download the that punctuation mark to have available on your BlackBerry or your Mac or your PC. So I guess it keeps it legit. You know, if they're filing a patent to protect their mark, then I really don't see any harm for that. I mean, there's plenty of pay-for fonts out there. If enough people download it, maybe it'll become very mainstream. Maybe you'll see it introduced into the lexicon and into the dictionaries and everything. I think it's an appropriate time to introduce something like that.
Yeah, we need something because this happens to me all the time. And it's not even necessarily sarcasm sometimes. It's, you know, maybe some sort of punctuation mark that can show mood. You know, it's like maybe you're not talkative. It doesn't mean that you're mad at the person, but it's like, I'm typing one word. So it's like, well, why are you typing one word? Because I'm on a freaking mobile phone and it's a pain in the ass to write a paragraph. It's easier to just truncate everything into a yes, no, I'm fine, you know, sort of deal.
Well, I mean, you know, because you must see it all the time, arguments that stem from misunderstandings, particularly like through Twitter and Facebook. It doesn't take much for somebody to take something out of context and then boom, snowballs into this giant thing. We had the issue with Chris Rager being hospitalized and the way a website treated that news. And I really do think the author was misattributed. I really didn't think it was meant the way that people perceived it. So again, it's really tough when you're using a text-based form of communication for people to understand some of the more underlying content there. So But my concern is, okay, so you can introduce a new form of punctuation for sarcasm, and like you said, Kyle, you know, where's it going to stop? You know, do you have to go, well, you know, I'm feeling pissy today, so we're going to use this form of punctuation, and I'm feeling really lethargic, and we can use this, and I'm really, really happy, so I'm going to use this. It is a phenomenon that can get incredibly out of control, but I think if we deal with the sarcasm first, it'd be great.
Yeah, Deadly Loofah in our chat room here from Deadly Loofah Radio, which we've promoted here on this podcast before. He says he just types /sarcasm at the end of the statement. You know, I guess that works too, but you know, it's more letters to type, I guess. But
I was just going to say that in this day and age, type more, you know, at that point you're pretty much explaining, you know, yourself away, and it kind of loses some of the appeal on that.
Yeah. And Miss November says we have to pay for punctuation, and like, oh yeah, well, let's put yourself in their shoes. If you came up with this revolutionary or potentially revolutionary piece of punctuation or something that can change the way people communicate, you're going to want a piece of the pie somehow, some way. Yeah, you file with the patent and the copyright office and all that, but you know, a lot of people didn't protect themselves, and you know, things that you assume made someone a lot of money didn't. The guy who says you've got mail, I mean, I don't know. We talked about that story before, right? It's not like he can make royalties or residuals from every time that gets played on someone's computer.
No, it was like the story we were talking about last week with Jack Kirby. You work for hire. You get an agent. Your agent calls you in. You audition. Boom. You say these three words. When you're compensated for it, you get that check and you go and cash it. That's it. All ties are cut off at that point. So, yeah, you know, people are hearing it a billion times a day. He get that one paycheck, and I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a nice feather in his cap. It's a nice little thing to put on the resume, but you realistically can't expect this guy to get paid every time you hear that. Even if he was getting a penny for every time that happened, people would have to be forking over, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to this guy annually. That's just not going to happen.
Nah, not so much, but it is a nice notch on the resume. It's like, hey, I'm that guy. I'm like, oh, cool. Well, maybe we'll hire you. Yes.
Or maybe you're some typecast at that point. They're like, no, not that you have mail guy. No, anybody does.
Yeah, poor guy's homeless. He'll end up on a VH1 Where Are They Now special.
He's like gonna end up in right. The celebrity drug clinic.
It'll be celebrity rehab next to Tom Sizemore and everything. Like, hey, what's up? I'm the You've Got Mail guy. It's like, you are? Like, yeah, I've been using. Sorry. God. All right. Into another story here that... well, we got it's an interesting thing here, and we'll see how everyone feels about this. U.S. Airways thwarts possible terrorist threat from an Xbox. Got this story originally from Gizmodo, and the story is this guy checked his luggage and a brand new Xbox 360, checked it in on a flight from Boston. Didn't take it on the carry-on. He friggin' checked it in. So when he got to his destination, can you imagine what happened? Yes, he received a Ziploc bag of some of the components and then a massively busted up Xbox. And U.S. Airways basically said, too bad, so sad, you know, security protocol. So was the airline justified in inspecting, or is this guy maybe a scam artist who maybe his Xbox had the red ring of death and he figured he'd go check it in knowing it was going to get smashed and maybe he could get a free Xbox out of U.S. Airways?
I don't get the issue was flying with an Xbox. I didn't know it was like contraband.
Well, I mean, if you're going to fly with electronics, I think most common sense would tell you try and keep it either in your carry-on or, you know, put it in the compartment overhead. But even, you know, an Xbox should be okay in there because those overhead bins are stuffed with people's stuff, you know, and I don't see an Xbox getting as smashed as you guys should see the link. Go to our Facebook page and scroll down to the link about the Xbox threat, and you can see how torn apart this Xbox is. It's funny. It's just hysterical. And if he had taken it with him on the actual flight in the cabin with him, it would not have ended up that way.
Right. I don't know. It's probably a scam. It may have been ROD'd for all we know. I always harken back to flying to Maryland for Otakon, and I had a Pokemon ball with a 24-karat gold Pikachu card inside because Riko Matsumoto was going to be there and I wanted to sign it. And holy shit, did that like set off a shitstorm with security. They thought it was a bomb when they saw it in the X-ray, and they detained my wife and I, and they had to clear the area and check our luggage. And it's like, it's a fucking Pokemon ball. Come on, give me a break. but I don't know about the Xbox thing. I wouldn't try that. I wouldn't try that just because I wouldn't want somebody to make an accusation about trying to fly with contraband. Oh, it's a bomb. The guy's the Xbox bomber. Holy shit.
And you know, Al-Qaeda and everyone is going laughing at this story going, you know what? We should try that. It's like, then we're going to ban laptops and phones. We're going to ban all electronics from flights and just piss everyone off. It can happen. I mean, the guy from what, Nigeria, tried to light his junk on fire, his underwear and everything. And that, you know, luckily, I think the security, they bumped it up a notch for about a week or two, and then they relaxed. It's like before, it's like people can't get up to even pee. You can't do it during the last hour of the flight, and you can't have anything in your lap, not even a book or a magazine. It's like, what?
Or a stewardess.
You can't have a stewardess in your lap. I'm sorry, flight attendant.
Flight attendants. PC, sorry.
Yeah, that's right. We can't say stewardess because some flight attendants are male. So that'd be a steward. Call him Stewie.
Yeah, there you go, Stewie. All right, moving on. What are we moving on to? Can commenting affect your credit? I always think of you, Kyle, when I read this story. This is like my bedtime story every night before I go to bed. I read this article. So I'm very, very careful about what I post online. Did you know that everything you and those in your network do and discuss online may be compiled and provided to creditors? If your settings are tuned to public, it's true. This includes your Facebook status updates, Twitter tweets, joining online clubs, linking a website, and even posting a comment on a news blog. It's fascinating stuff. In hopes of identifying good credit customers, some financial institutions are tapping into the information you and your friends reveal online. The idea is that your friends you keep and the data you disclose may help them make more accurate business decisions. Companies such as Rapleaf hunt and gather social networking transmissions, turning the conversations you have in your networks into consumer profiles. These profiles provide banks with insight into your behavior patterns, what you like and dislike, want and don't want, do well and do poorly. There are a couple of ways this information has been applied. It can help creditors promote certain products, cutting down on marketing waste. Why send pre-approved letters to people not interested, right? Lowering lending risks is another reason. Creditors can see if people in your network have accounts with them, and if they are are free to look at how they are handling those accounts. The presumption is that if those in your network are responsible cardholders, there's a better chance you will be too. So if the bank is on the fence about whether to extend your credit, you may become eligible if those in your network are good credit customers. Having a robust online social network can also expedite loan acceptances. If you're connected to a lot of people who have great credit risk, it can speed you through the process. And while financial institutions and companies that gather your online data are empathetic, that is the idea to increase the odds of a person getting credit, what you reveal online can have unintended consequences. Therefore, if you want to opt out, turn all of your settings to private. Other best practices: don't accept invitations to your social network site for people until you check their profiles out first. Be acutely aware of what you write. Don't make public anything you don't want public, Kyle. And take an annual inventory of all your social networking sites and delete people and information that can potentially damage you in the eyes of a creditor or employer. Kyle, there's a problem. There's a problem to going completely underground, of course, and if you're like me and you want to be found, you won't be. So I don't know. It's a weird phenomenon, but again, I think it's something we saw a long way coming, where because of the prevalence of all these social sites, we've talked about people losing jobs or being denied insurance because of things they post. Yeah, it makes sense that if you're putting all this out there, your creditor's going to watch it too. And if you're at credit risk, this shit's public. They're reading the stuff and they're going, well, we're not going to extend Kyle's credit this month because we're looking at all the stuff he bought last month and he hasn't paid for it yet. So it's weird. It's crazy. It's creepy, especially with Facebook tweaking their privacy settings. There are a few tutorials online if you want to go ahead and reestablish your privacy settings on Facebook. And I personally would encourage you all to do that, because if you don't, people see this stuff and it's going to affect you in the long term. You might be a youngin' now, but if it starts jacking with your credit rating by the time you're older and you want to get married and buy a house, you may not be able to buy a house. And That's the big drawback there.
I'm personally not worried because my credit's already in the toilet, and it's not because of social networks. At least I'm pretty sure it is, because my credit's always been in the toilet long before Facebook and Twitter and MySpace and anything, any social media. So I'm not worried about it. I don't put out there. I think about what I put out there. I really, really do. I know, Steve, it doesn't seem like I do, but I do. Like,
ready to piss my pants here about the hilarity of that statement.
I understand, because that's only funny to you because you personally wouldn't put out there what you put out there. I mean, we had a discussion about it on the last show or the show before that about it's like, I don't care that you're checking in and eating a sandwich somewhere. It's like, well, some people do, and they make a social app out of it because you earn badges. It's kind of like a video game. It's a social gaming. That's why I play Gowalla and Foursquare, and you see those updates on Facebook saying so-and-so checked in because I get, you know, points or whatever. It's like achievements. Why do people unlock achievements on Xbox? There's no real point. You just do it. It's just fun.
You're afraid of, like, some Mark David Chapman dude's going to find out, you know, you're having a burrito down the street and some crazed Eisen fans, you know, go, oh, holy shit, Kyle just, you know, posted that he's having a burrito down the street and then getting up with a bullet, you know, for supper. I understand that's yeah, and it's an absolute worst case scenario. I understand that, and I really don't want anybody to think I'm making light of that. But you know, I read an article not too long ago that, you know, people would post, you know, hey, me and the wife and the kids are going to Disney for a week, and they come home and their house is ransacked because you know, you're putting that out there publicly. You're not going to be home, so people are like, hey, there's a big red flag. Kyle's not going to be home for the next week. Let's go loot, because we know from all his posts that he has an HDTV and an Xbox and a PS3 and all this neat swag. Therein lies the danger about you know, being really, really careful about what you post.
Oh yeah, but then again, they don't know what I'm choosing not to post. If I could have a house sitter or tell my neighbors that I trust to keep an eye on the place, or, and what I do with the checking in from a restaurant thing, I actually don't post that till I'm about ready to leave. So anyone who would stalk me, and I'm not saying that from an egotistical standpoint, like, of course the guy, I have stalkers. No, I mean, if there's some crazy loony person out there who's following me on Facebook and sees that I'm at In-N-Out Burger eating, He's in for a shock. When he shows up there, I'm not there because I've checked in right as I'm leaving. It uses the GPS on my phone, so yeah, it shows like the location and all that, but I'm one step ahead. Don't worry.
I'm not worried because I don't post a lot of personal stuff. Because I am a little paranoid. It's not like I'm reclusive or anything, but I get paranoid. I remember when your website first launched way, way, way back in 2001, people doing a whois, and I was the register, and using my home phone number and getting phone calls at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know Kyle. Can I talk to Kyle? And it's like, wow, you know, just having that information out there and having people fanatical enough and then, you know, ringing my house, it's like, wow, okay, that's a little scary when you start getting stuff like that out there. So I'm relatively protective because through association, I don't want that type of attention.
And I know it is a delicate balance. And I'm an actor, and I'm in the business of trying to promote myself, market myself. And yeah, you can still reach a lot of people through social media without putting the level of detail that I choose to put out there. And that's just a personal decision for me. I still draw the line. I don't sit there and say, hey, everyone, here's my daughter, because that's just not good. I mean, you protect your family. You know, I recently did set – well, I'm not even going to say that, I guess. Anyway, I can say it because it's protected. But my daughter wanted her own Facebook page. And it's protected. I set it up. No one can access it but her and her personal friends. So, you know, I don't have to worry about that, at least. And she's fine with that. She doesn't understand the whole concept of privacy and this, that, and the other yet. She'll pick up on it, I'm sure, eventually. But, yeah, I'm not, like, posting, you know, uber, uber personal things. You know, sometimes, yeah, I like to keep it real because – I want to demonstrate, you know, for example, because I do voice acting, trying to set a realistic picture of the landscape to people that it's like, despite having some nice things on my resume, how cool it is and how much money those properties make, I was paid one time for them when I recorded, and that money has long been spent. And I am at a, you know, financial crossroads. I'm at a low point. I can't get credit. I can't get any more money. I need a job. So now I've signed up to work as an extra on at Central Casting for TV shows and movies. It's not glorious, but it's money. You know, it pays you $100 for the day, maybe a little bit more. You got to sit on set all day, but you know, you got to do what you got to do, just like everyone else, to make ends meet.
This is true. And that's why you can find me on the corner Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. But sometimes it doesn't even have to be something, you know, that you perceive as getting out there. There's a story this past week about some high school kids who were getting drafted by a college to play football. And they put on their Facebook, boobies. Well, not boobies. They put something else. Because they're excited. They saw boobies. And come to find out, the recruiter for the college took them to a strip club. So now there's this huge investigation, and they're looking into how do they recruit players to bring them over to universities and everything. They kind of blew the whistle on the whole scheme, kind of unintentionally. They didn't get into the specifics of how the recruiters took them to the strip clubs and blah, 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 and they weren't old enough to get in, but they got them in and blah, blah, blah. Just the fact that they mentioned that they went to a strip club, you did the math. Well, where were they at the time when they posted this and blah, blah, blah? And it turned into a real, real big issue. So even though you're thinking before you post it, I don't mean this at you directly, Kyle, so it's a blanket statement. But even though you're thinking, what you think is nice and sweet and innocuous, it could have these tremendous ramifications.
Absolutely. I mean, who would have thought that John Lennon would get shot? You know, it's like, what? Crazy. I mean, who would assassinate presidents? I mean, anything is possible in this world. Anything. And, you know, Rule 34, if it exists, there's porn of it.
Is there Kyle porn on the internet?
I don't think so. There is avatar porn.
There is avatar porn. Yes. You actually linked over to some avatar porn. Thank you very much.
I did. It was really, really funny. Not for the little kids, obviously. But it was funny.
And I can't unsee that. So thank you very much, Abar.
Yeah. And did you know that Hustler's actually making a real live action avatar porn?
I did see that. What is it? This is not Avatar XXX.
Yeah, they have this line of live-action parody porns, like, you know, Married with Children, The Cosby Show, The Brady Bunch, all of this, just porn versions, and apparently now they're going to do giant blue cats.
And the sad part is there's a huge market for that.
Yes, actually, you know, the furries will be happy, even though I think technically Na'vi aren't furries, but whatever. We're talking Avatar here. This story actually comes from io9.com. Believe it or not, Avatar is killing people, and we're not talking about the reviews either. Apparently, 42-year-old Taiwanese man who had a history of high blood pressure started feeling ill during a screening of Avatar in 3D. He was taken to a local hospital and arrived unconscious, and scans showed that his brain was hemorrhaging. And the doctor made a statement that said, quote, "It's likely that the overexcitement from watching the movie triggered his symptoms." The man died 11 days later. Now, the story that we were going to cover last week and didn't because of time was something about post-Avatar depression, where people are so depressed about not being able to experience Pandora and all of that wonderful iGasmic stuff. And now this story about someone dropping dead, basically, from seeing the film. Is IMAX 3D going to have to cover their ass with some sort of disclaimer the way that theme parks do? It's like, warning, this film has pretty stuff in it that'll give you a heart attack. I don't know.
Get a furry stuck in my throat. You know, again, saw this coming 15,000 miles down the highway. You know, you're going to go see this movie in IMAX 3D. Holy shit, it made me sick. When are we going to see the mass litigation for IMAX movies making people feel discomforted and having to be hospitalized? I don't really know that you can blame the fact that you knowingly and willingly purchased a movie ticket and watched a movie and got a little too excited about the furries and you dropped dead. If that can really promote any litigation, it's, I don't know, frivolous in my eyes. Then again, going to see Avatar is kind of frivolous in my eyes, too.
Yeah, see, you refuse to go see it, and when it comes out on video, you're gonna go, "Huh, that's it?" And we go, "Dude, it doesn't compare to seeing in the theater." It's like, I don't care.
Well, you know, I don't live in a major metropolis. IMAX isn't necessarily accessible to me. It becomes an event. You know, it takes me a while to get to an IMAX theater, and you know, it turns into like dinner and a movie and drinks afterwards. It's not, hey, I'm going to the movies. So, you know, we talked a long time ago about when Star Wars Episode One came out, about the biggest hindrance to that film was not every theater was projecting in digital. And still a lot of theaters are still traditional film and not digital projection. Not a lot of them have wondrous surround sound. So to release a movie like Avatar, and everybody, including yourself, Kyle, you got to see us in IMAX, got to see it 3D, and this is what it was made for. Well, you know, probably the majority of the audience that went to go see this movie saw it in traditional theaters on a traditional screen, either with film or digital projection, in either stereo or some mock 3D sound. It's just not out there. It's still not accessible for everybody. So to say this is the way films are going to be made and we can do so much with this, well, let's get the IMAX theaters out there. Let's make it a lot more accessible to people, because that point is very valid. Even if you buy it on Blu-ray and you watch it back in HDTV, it's not the IMAX experience. You're never going to recapture that experience again. So, you know, what's this thing going to do? Spend an eternity in IMAX theaters or continuous re-releases in IMAX so that people can have that experience? People are going to buy it regardless when it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray, but it's not going to be the same. So how do you remedy that situation?
Well, to answer one of your points, IMAX Digital is an offshoot from IMAX, and I believe AMC are partner with them. So you can get the IMAX digital presentation and 3D presentation. The problem is they charge the full IMAX screen price. An IMAX screen is about 75 feet tall. IMAX digital screens out of these AMC theaters are 35 feet tall, and you pay the same amount. I saw Avatar for a second time last week. I paid $17, and it hurt. As much as I love seeing that movie and how great the 3D was, I couldn't help but just like, oh, my wallet hurts. $17 friggin' dollars for that movie, and it's not even a full IMAX presentation. It was digital. It looked and sounded fantastic, but oy. But that is a way the IMAX is trying to get their brand into more theaters. So IMAX Digital, chances are you've got one, probably at least one theater that has IMAX Digital, if not a full IMAX screen.
I don't know. It's this technology is out there now, and I understand people want to embrace it. But again, because it isn't that accessible, what can you do? You know, and that kind of leads me right up into our next story. You know, Cameron did a lot more harm than good by making Avatar because, holy shit, let's talk Star Wars. Star Wars 3D has been given a new lease on life thanks to James Cameron's Avatar. According to Star Wars creator George Lucas, the project has been stalled, but after seeing Avatar become such a success at the cinema, it has given him a new hope to make the project a success. I'm happy it's so successful and worked very well in 3D, Lucas explained to Access Hollywood about Avatar. I haven't been a big fan of 3D, but that movie definitely improves the field of 3D. When prompted about his own 3D plans, he noted, We've been looking for years and years of trying to take Star Wars and put it in 3D, but the technology hasn't been there. We've been struggling with it, but I think this will be a new impromptu to make this happen. And I'm just going to stop the article right there because I'm not even going to get into the quadruple and sextuple and octuple dipping that we as Star Wars fans have done with all these different editions that come out. And everybody's still waiting for this tremendous Blu-ray edition to come out with all the deleted scenes added back in and alternate camera angles and this and that. When I'm talking about presenting Star Wars in 3D and giving it the IMAX treatment, thanks to what Cameron did with Avatar, it's the same scenario. You're going to release this thing on Blu-ray, you're going to release it on DVD, it's going to look like ass at home. So, you know, our movie theater is going to change up where, and I'm not even kidding when I say they're going to keep Avatar in rotation, Star Wars in rotation, and they'll still come in and introduce the new films, and when those expire, they'll pull them out. But something like Star Wars, that's monumental. That's a part of our lives. It's part of us. And if you don't feel like checking it out when it comes out next year or whatever, you want to see it 2 years from now, you're not going to get that same satisfaction watching it at home. So I don't know. Maybe it's an incredibly ingenious idea on behalf of IMAX to say, well, we got a tremendous property like Star Wars, and we can just keep this in rotation in our theaters for the next 20 years, and people will keep lining up and buying tickets. Because, again, for the final time, it's the only way you're really going to enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, And it's funny with the Star Wars fans, we're so friggin' fickle. We will all sit here and bitch about getting quadruple time to the nth power dipped on seeing these movies yet again in whatever gimmick. But we're all lining up, and at the end of the day, they're making money off of it, so they don't care that the fans are bitching. They made their money, and will continue to.
I don't know. You know, we talked about CES, and the big thing this year was 3D TV. And after watching some of the video reviews and some of the text articles about people attending CES, they said, no, the technology is not there yet. It's kind of like virtual reality. Where virtual reality, I'm sure you remember, Kyle, the days of Lawnmower Man, this was going to be the big craze. This is going to be the trend. We were going to get rid of our TVs and our computers and everything. Everything's going to be VR, and it's going to change the landscape. What happened to VR? It sounded much better than the way it was implemented. And I think that's what happened with 3D TV. It sounded great in concept, but when you start to see some of these production models, and Sony's releasing one, I think, third quarter of this year, it's not there. It's not what it should be. And if you want a really good 3D experience, you're still going to wear the glasses. Watching traditional 3D on a TV that's supposed to display in 3D without the glasses, it's just, it's icky. And to spend a lot of money on icky, you got to look at the economic climate. People, these first adopters, I don't think are going to forever be first adopters. Kyle, you and I both, where we have adopted early, you a lot more than me, certainly. I know it's the furthest thing from your mind to say, I'm going to go drop $6,000 on a 3D TV. I mean, it's just not economically viable. And having said that, I don't think it's going to be a viable market for it at all. It's something that may be revisited 10 or 15 years from now, but I got to blame this all on Cameron and Avatar. Yes, you may have released a truly visionary movie in terms of visual effects, but it's not something that can be replicated on the cheap or on the home market.
No, and being a true lover of film like he is, an auteur, you're going to hear the arguments from filmmakers that, you know, we want to perfect and evolve the art form. And of course, the studios are going, yeah, we want to get people out of their house and into the theaters and justify that cost. So yeah, you're going to pay a premium, but you're going to get content that you can't, that can't possibly be replicated, at least not to the same level at home. I played at a friend's house, the Avatar PS3 game, and it was in 3D, and it looked kind of cool, but it wasn't a game changer like the movie itself. It was just like, I'm wearing 3D glasses, and it looks like these pixels are sort of in front of me. It wasn't anything groundbreaking, and his TV is like 3D ready and all that, and it's like, wow, this is what Sony is amping to do with its next generation of games. Fortunately, it's backwards compatible, but, you know, 3D Blu-ray will be. And you can't get the maximum 3D benefit without upgrading to a 3D TV. But yeah, who's going to pay extra? Because they've already come out and said, you're going to pay extra for that 3D feature on your TV. And people are going to lose the glasses. The kids are going to break them. You know, all these different, the dog's going to eat them. And at the end of the day, no one's going to want to go for it. It's certainly not the first iteration of it. Not 3D. It is too gimmicky, even still.
And not just that. We had discussed previously, because God knows at this point, I'm a huge proponent of digital downloads. If I can download a game from the comfort of my home instead of having to hop in my car and drive to Best Buy and plunk down $60, I'd rather download it. But, you know, what are some of the hurdles to that? The biggest one is bandwidth, and the second one is storage. Particularly if you have an Xbox 360 and you have the standard drive, you're really not sticking a lot of games on that puppy, unless you want to sink a lot more money into your console. So at CES, one of the biggest topics of discussion was, okay, we've got this 3D technology now. How the hell are we going to store this stuff? You know, do we have to make new Blu-ray with even more storage capacity? Are people going to be able to stream this stuff, like via Netflix or whatever? Because you're talking about an insane amount of data. It's not your standard rate of data to watch this kind of film. So, again, it's kind of funny that you have this technology that's so far ahead of its time, and they're really hoping to cash in on it. And everybody's going, wait a minute, can we even do this? Is this even possible? And can we profit from it if we have to put so much behind it?
I know that, first of all, I don't have the money to upgrade to a 3D TV, so I'm not really worried about it. And again, based on just what I've seen from the PlayStation 3 3D stuff, yeah, I can wait gladly. It's fine. Blu-ray is like the pinnacle of home video quality for movies and stuff. So, yeah.
And game graphics have come an incredibly far way. I'm a huge fan of God of War. Big shock there, I know. And I picked up the God of War collection on Blu-ray. And they didn't really update the graphics. They kept them intact, but they made it more smooth. The frame rate's a lot higher, and it's all in HD. But you go online, and even watching a YouTube video of God of War 3, the technology that is being brought into gaming is incredible. You're also talking about production schedules and budgets like a feature film. You're talking about 4 years in production with a $300 million budget. It's insane. I'm totally happy with that. I'm so happy with the way video games are being presented. Now, it doesn't have to be in 3D. I think it's plenty immersive enough. It's not Atari anymore, kids.
Mm-hmm. And on the God of War 3 thing, I was reading on a Heavy Metal News website that a lot of bands are doing a compilation soundtrack for that will only be in the deluxe edition, which I think is $100. But it's got, you know, a new instrumental from Dream Theater. It's got Opeth. It's got all these bands that I like. So I don't know if I want to pay an extra $40 just to get that. I don't know. Are you getting the deluxe version, dude? Are you getting the Pandora's box? No! Don't sit there, you bad man.
No, you know, and again, this is a topic that's been beaten to the ground. I don't believe in super uber collector's editions. It's so much crap that I just don't have the room for. I haven't bought a collector's edition in forever. I don't have a place for a Master Chief helmet and a Batarang and all this stuff that's just going to collect dust when it, you know, isn't the popular thing anymore. But I will say, I will admit, for the first time ever on the BBB, I saw Pandora's box and I drooled a little. I said, ooh, that looks pretty sweet. But you look at what's in it, it's not worth the money. I mean, they're really not. The majority of what you buy in that box is downloadable. That soundtrack you're talking about, Kyle, there's not a physical disc. You get a code to download it. So you're spending all this money for a bunch of download codes. It just seems ridiculous. And then you have different retailers with different perks. If you buy it from Walmart, you can get this costume. If you get it from Target, you can get this costume. If you pre-order on Amazon, you can get this costume. In the end, we know what's going to happen. It's all going to end up in the PlayStation shop. You're going to be able to pay to download all this shit, and it really doesn't matter. So to have a $100 hunk of plastic on my shelf, it's just not worth it. But I do want to throw this out, and thanks to our engineer Mark for making me aware of this a couple days ago. God of War 3 was supposed to be the end of the franchise. Well, guess what? It's not going to be. Haha, big surprise, because the thing's just so freaking lucrative. Sony has come out and did a press release and said, we're going to keep making God of War games. You know, yeah, we told you this was the last one, but, you know, not a yes, we kind of lied. So I don't know how to feel about that, because it may cheapen the franchise. We start getting a God of War game every year, every 2 years. It's not going to be the greatness that is God of War. So, I don't know. I know God of War 3 is going to be great. It just might be the last God of War game I play.
Speedy D in our chat room says, Oprah, the video game. Now, there is a franchise I can get behind. But let me roll down some calendar dates to mark down for some geeky TV and movie release to look forward to over the next month. February 2nd, we'll see the release of Doctor Who, The End of Time, Part 1 and 2. Hellboy, Sword of Storms and Blood and Iron, which are already out on DVD, make their Blu-ray debut. And Zombieland, there's my purchase for February 2nd, definitely. February 9th, Halo Legends, the anime anthology, yes. Stargate Universe Season 1. On February 23rd, the new animated Justice League Crisis on Two Earths, which would be cool, because I think the Spectre's in there for the first time. I think he's on that one. And then March 2nd, if you want to see the Earth explode, from Roland Emmerich, 2012. The original Clash of the Titans comes to Blu-ray. Fantasia and Fantasia 2000 come back to home video. The original 1984 Never-Ending Story makes its Blu-ray debut. Ponyo for the Miyazaki fans. And Where the Wild Things Are, the kind of misfire. There you go. So there is some release dates.
You're talking release dates. It just popped in my head. Have you seen the trailer blitz for Kick-Ass? Have you been following this?
I've seen some of the trailers, yes, in theaters and online.
Oh my god, total joygasm. That is going to be my peak of 2010, I think. If there's anything I'm really excited about coming out theatrically, it's Kick-Ass. It's something that was done on the cheap. It was filmed independently and then shopped later on. They get all the rights from the comic creators and everything. Supposed to be a really faithful translation. But every trailer I see, I get more and more excited about it because I think primarily because Nick Cage has got a really bad rap in film, and this is one film where he could be really campy and be himself and totally get away with it because it meets up with his character. And seeing an 11-year-old running around and blowing people's brains out in the most graphic and gory of detail, fangasm. I cannot wait for that flick.
Yeah, I guess this will take Leon the Professional to the next level, because that was about, you know, Natalie Portman when she was 12 becoming an assassin. And then, of course, if you're an anime fan, you've seen Gunslinger Girl. But yeah, this one amped up. And I'm all for seeing Nick Cage in something that I can get behind, because I'm used to him just being Nick Cage. And to me, my favorite Nick Cage role, Raising Arizona. Man, that was a long time ago. But damn, what a funny movie.
We've been talking about film, so let's kind of go into internet film and talk about YouTube. YouTube just announced that it will begin supporting HTML5 video players this evening, kids. If you go to YouTube right now, you might actually be able to catch it in the works across many of its videos on the site. The feature isn't live yet, expected to be within the next hour or two. This is at the posting of this article, which is about 5 hours ago, so it should be live now. And if the test goes live site-wise, it would be a good thing for the web. I didn't check into this yet, so take my word for it. An HTML5 video player will allow videos to be viewed without Adobe's Flash Player plugin. Videos will load faster, and developers will be able to build all kinds of other intriguing features into a media delivery scheme based on the next version of HTML. For now, users will need to sign up in the HTML5 preview on the test tube, and they'll need to be using either Chrome Safari or the Chrome Frame in IE. The biggest benefit of HTML5 support is that it frees users from the need to use proprietary plugins like Flash Player or Microsoft Silverlight by using a simple bit of code to render videos. If you've used Google's Chrome much, you've probably seen how often Flash Player crashes in that browser. Firefox doesn't deal with Flash well either. HTML5 is being edited by Ian Hickson of Google and David Hyatt of Apple. Weird combination there. Expect to see Google and Apple support this new standard all the more in the future, so that those companies and others can build a web that looks more like Gmail on an iPhone than it does like a Flash landing page from last decade. And again, for more details, you can go over to YouTube, check out TestTube, check out this new HTML5 format. And I say, whatever's faster, quicker, and doesn't crash as often makes me a happy camper.
Yay, not crashing, which, you know, Firefox does a lot of, although I've updated my browser to a release candidate of the next version of Firefox, and I haven't had any crashes. I get freezes, but I have a crappy laptop, so it happens whether I use Internet Explorer or not, but who knows? Maybe I'm downloading too much porn. Maybe not. I don't know. You know, yeah, we got to the point where I never thought YouTube would get, which, you know, HD videos, and then YouTube is going to start, like, movie rentals. I don't really see how that's going to work, but, I mean, since Netflix can stream on everything already, but who knows? Everyone has a model in place to start making money off the interwebs. We'll see what happens, but, you know, yeah, I guess with, you know, HD stuff, you know, like the Muppets Bohemian Rhapsody was the first, you know, full, I guess, 1080p video on YouTube, and it caused a lot of stuttering and buffering and taking forever to load and all that. And yeah, if you could bypass all that shit, yeah, all for it.
That video in particular looked great. It looked phenomenal.
Yeah, and putting, you know, phenomenal video quality and YouTube in the same sentence seems like a paradox. An oxymoron. Is that the right word? Yeah, whatever. A contradiction in terms. How's that?
I think it's great that YouTube keeps pushing the envelope, because it's not so much about existing content, network content, or cable content, but just for user-created content to be able to have people showcase their wares in a higher quality. It's not all people who film themselves with their iPod for silly little TV shows like Kyle TV. You have, you know, indie filmmakers and college students who do phenomenal work, and it kind of discredits what they're doing when you're watching this grainy, choppy video on a website. And recently, I think ever since YouTube went ahead and introduced the HD to it, I've read more and more stories of these little indie filmmakers getting huge Hollywood deals because they're showcasing their wares out there. And I think, yeah, the prettier the package looks, the more enticing it is for somebody to say, hey, I can really see what you're bringing to the table. Come and, you know, work for us.
Yeah, considering that indie filmmaker in South America for $300 on his software or whatever made this giant robot invasion short and you know, on his comments, you know, Hollywood bigwigs start messaging him saying, hey, we got a deal for you. It's like, really? So everyone is looking to YouTube as, you know, not only a great bastion for content and finding things like, oh, remember this quote or this, that, and the other. It's actually getting people work. That's exciting. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, for a long time, we've been wanting to do a music video for Perimeter of the Void, and the thought of hosting sorry, I get uber distracted. The thought of hosting an HD video on my server and sucking up all that bandwidth just... It was such a crippling idea. I was like, no, this isn't going to happen. Then to look at YouTube and go, wow, you know, free, humongous uploads, gigs worth of data, HD video for the world to see and stream for free, it makes it that much more tantalizing. So I really have to give props to YouTube. They're not as evil as everybody thought. I really don't have a big complaint with them going after the copyright infringers, as they should. But the services we're providing for the sake of having to deal with some ads embedded in the video or in the sidebar, it's all worth it. I mean, we're almost getting to the point where you can dump your cable TV because YouTube is becoming that entertaining. There's like a million videos being uploaded a minute. So the content's there, and now the quality is finally there to match it. And now you have a new format that hopefully won't crash and it plays back faster and loads faster and everything. Again, I's a happy camper.
Yes, but if you want to take certain music videos and embed them on your blog, that may be a different uphill battle. Let's move on to our next YouTube story here from the band OK Go, who have this really fun, creative new music video. I linked to it on my Twitter about a week or two ago. It's called This Too Shall Pass. It's basically one long take on a video camera in a field featuring the Notre Dame marching band. Popping up out of nowhere. So I shared this, and most people will do the same thing and retweet or repost on Facebook. But others like to embed YouTube content on their blogs to share. And as far as OK Go goes, you can't embed the YouTube version of the videos. You can with MySpace and Vimeo, but YouTube won't let you do it. So is YouTube playing Big Brother? Nope. Apparently a lot of their fans were making an uproar. So much to the fact that the singer Daniel Kulash wrote this really, really long letter explaining the situation. And I found this linked on Engadget, and you can find that linked on our Facebook page. Remember, just go to thebigballbroadcast.com, click through there. You'll be able to find our Facebook page link directly, and you can read this letter in full. But I'm going to read some of the bullet points for you, direct quotation here from OK Go. It's pretty interesting, Steve, and I'll definitely want to hear your two cents on this, being a musician yourself. 15 years ago, this quote from the singer of OK Go, when the terms of contracts like ours were dreamt up, a major label could record two cats fighting in a bag, and 3 months later they have a hit. No more. People of the world, there has been a revolution. You no longer give a shit what major labels want you to listen to. Good job, world. And you no longer spend money actually buying the music you listen to. Perhaps not so good job, world. So the money that is used to flow through the music business has slowed to a trickle, and every label, large or small, is scrambling to catch every last drop. You can't blame them. They need new shoes, just like everybody else, and musicians need them to survive so we can use them as banks. Even bands like us, who do most of our own promotion, still need them to write checks every once in a while. And here's another quote. But where are they going to find money if no one buys music? One target is radio stations, and another is our friend the internauts. The labels are hurting, and they need every penny they can find, so they've demanded a piece of the action. They got all huffy a couple years ago and threatened all sorts of legal terror, and eventually all four majors struck deals with YouTube, which pay them tiny, tiny sums of money every time one of their videos gets played. Seems like a fair enough solution, right? YouTube gets to keep the content, and the labels get some income. The catch, the software that pays out those tiny sums doesn't pay if a video is embedded. This means our label doesn't get their hand one share of the pie if our video is played on your blog. So, surprise, surprise, they won't let us be on your blog. In the meantime, the only thing OK Go can do to upload our videos to sites that allow for embedding, like MySpace and Vimeo. We do that already, but it stings a little. Not only does it cannibalize our own numbers, it tends to do our business more good to get 40 million hits on one site as opposed to 1 million hits on 40 sites. But as you can imagine, we feel a lot of allegiance to the fine people at YouTube. They've been good to us, and what they want is what we want. Lots of people to see our videos. When push comes to shove, however, we like our fans more, which is why you can take the code at the bottom of this email and embed this too shall pass video all over the internet. So basically, what the message here amounts to is while the band's there for their music and their fans, EMI still has to answer to their shareholders. Steve, discuss.
I don't understand why, really, because it's pulling from the source. It's an embed code. It's got the URL embedded in the code, so it should be able to track where it's coming from. Mark and I were discussing earlier about the Big Ball broadcast. Everything that we record gets uploaded to archive.org, and it doesn't matter if we have the player embedded on our site or where people get the link from, iTunes or whatever. We can track all the downloads. I don't understand why the same doesn't apply. The technology is certainly there. It's been there for years. It's nothing new. So if I embed a video at my blog or on my website, the artist should get the residuals as if somebody went over to YouTube and watched it to begin with. I don't understand why that's an issue. But if it is an issue, I really don't have a problem with disabling embedding. Really, as an artist, I have a very skewed approach to it. I want to make money. Why do people do it to begin with? To make money. It's wonderful to think that I'm in a band because I love being a musician. I like showcasing my wares. And it's just really beautiful to think that Kyle really enjoys doing voice acting because he enjoys the properties, loves going to cons and meet people. That's a very rainbow and unicorn and ice cream way of looking at it. The bottom line is we need money to survive. We got to pay our bills. So you need that revenue. If I'm not going to get the revenue because somebody's trying to embed on the page, yeah, okay, kill the embed. To me, it's really black and white.
And as far as fans go, they can just go to Vimeo or MySpace and get the embed codes there. So, yeah, the people get the hits. And I'm wondering if it just comes down to legalese in these contracts. Yeah, they're pulling from the same source code, but can someone who's sitting there hosting OK Go on their blog, are they going to come back and try and do some frivolous lawsuit saying, hey, I want a piece of the pie. You guys got hits because of people coming to my blog. And they're just covering their ass, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, that argument's existed as long as the internet's been around with content thieving and people capitalizing and profiteering and other people's work and whatever. It goes to show you, with the entertainment industry as a whole, it's kind of the Wild West now with this whole digital thing. Physical media is dead, so everybody's trying to figure out the rules now. And it's very hasty and half-assed in a lot of cases and very asinine in a lot of cases. And it's very unfair to the artists. But you can't blame the internet. Because the record labels are the ones still in control, and the record labels are the ones that are making these deals to have the artist material available on these sites and everything. So you really can't blame the technology. I blame the labels and the people in charge for not thinking about this 3, 4, 5 years ago. And that's why EBE Records exist. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Because it's about putting the money in the pockets of the artist and not having a label capitalize on somebody else's hard work. So again, if the only way they're going to make money is by not allowing these videos to be embedded, then I really don't see a problem with that. And like you said, Kyle, you can go to these sites and watch it. So really, what's the harm? Are you that freaking lazy that you can't click a link or you can't type in a search? You really got to put this on your blog? You really got to share it that way? I mean, yeah, it's great to help saturate the artist, but if that's not supporting the artist. You know, it's the same argument with the anime industry. Watching the fan subs and downloaded torrents and watching stuff on YouTube doesn't make you a fan. You're not supporting the industry. A fan supports the industry. A fan wants the creators to get their due and continue to make kick-ass product. So, yeah. You know, it's that same argument. It's the argument for everything else. So I don't have a problem with that.
No, and I'm fine with it, too, for that very same reason. What's wrong with clicking a link? I mean, yeah, the page looks cooler if the video is already embedded there, but is it really so hard to click on links? There are other links in the blogs anyway. You can't just have endless pages and scrolling and have everything there on one page. That's just crazy. Click a link, it'll open a new window, and bam, the content's there. So, yeah, there really is no problem with that.
I'm sure they're going to find a way in the very near future to maybe at least work out a deal with the labels to have the videos embedded in the artist sites, kind of a halfway compromise, which I think, you know, makes perfect sense. I really don't think it would be that hard to track that many IPs and everything. So, but again, right now it still is kind of the Wild West. It's going to take a couple more years before any type of standard is set forth by the digital technology. So if this is the way it has to be for the interim, then so be it.
Yes, exactly. So, okay, Go fans, if you really want that blog to have that video directly on there, go to their Vimeo page or go to MySpace. And if you want to just watch it, link to it. It's on YouTube. It's getting tons of hits, and deservedly so. It's a very creative video. It's very cool, and it's a catchy tune.
Here we were talking before the show on whether or not we had enough content before the show.
Yeah, I know. We always say, it's a slow news week. There's nothing to talk about. And then we just ramble on, and then we fill 90 minutes.
All right, we'll go with this last story because it's kind of related here to what we were just talking about. Digital music prices, are they illegally fixed? Federal lawsuit alleging collusion among the major record labels over digital download pricing can proceed, a three-judge appeals court panel ruled. As lawsuits go, this one's a humdinger, charging that the labels engaged in a price-fixing conspiracy to ensure that they each made about 70 cents per track sold online and that no one received a better deal than anyone else. The case had been earlier tossed for a failure to state a claim, but the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has reinstated it and ordered the trial judge to proceed with the case. The case in question is Star v. Sony BMG. Actually began life as a host of cases filed by various plaintiffs in various states and federal courts in 2005 and 2006. The cases were eventually consolidated into a single one to be heard in a New York federal court, and that case covers behavior that goes all the way back to those dark post-Napster days when the labels attempted to foist MusicNet and press play onto an unsuspecting public. Choking on my own disapprovement here. Those early services were at first the only way that the labels would allow the music to be sold over the internet, and the control exercise was extreme. They were actually label-controlled ventures. Neither store had a complete selection of music, and the DMR was flat-out ridiculous. DRM, sorry, was flat-out ridiculous. And here's how the complaint sketches the scene. To obtain internet music from all major record labels, a consumer initially would have to subscribe to both MusicNet and PressPlay at a cost of approximately $240 per year. Both services required consumers to agree to unpopular digital rights management terms, DRMs. For example, PressPlay prohibited consumers from copying more than two songs from any particular artist onto a CD each month. Music purchased from MusicNet and PressPlay would often expire unless repurchased. A MusicNet consumer would need to repurchase music each year, and a PressPlay consumer who's unsubscribed would immediately lose access to all the music he or she had purchased. MusicNet and PressPlay also did not allow consumers to transfer songs from their computers to portable digital music players like the iPod. One industry commentator observed that MusicNet and PressPlay did not offer reasonable prices, and one prominent computer industry magazine concluded that, quote, nobody in their right mind would want to use those services. Blah, 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 words, words, words. But the same thing, the same argument is being applied to iTunes, because iTunes, let's face it, it is the catch-all of the music industry right now. If people are downloading music, chances are, you know, 98% of them are downloading them from iTunes. It is a crazy market where analysts are predicting somewhere around $400 million a month is pure profit for Apple in the iTunes store. That's an insane amount of revenue, but, you know, the concession is they have a deal with all four of the major the four major music labels, and the labels are setting the price. So when you're looking at your your 99 cents or your $1.29 download, the label's setting the standard. Is it price fixing? Because of the prevalence of iTunes out there setting the standard for the price, everybody else kind of has to follow suit. You really can't charge more than that because iTunes is the cheaper route. People can go that way. And I guess if you charge less than that, it's not perceived as being the same caliber music, you know, that the major labels are offering. So I guess you could call it price fixing on behalf of the record labels. And it is really sad when you're talking about 70 cents going to the record labels. In some cases, this is a lot more. And I've said it over and over and over again. The only artist who's had the balls to go public on this topic has been Weird Al Yankovic, very demoningly stated, I get about 4 cents per download from the record label. And that's pretty pathetic when you're talking about a 99-cent download. For the artist who created this music and made it available to begin with, it's getting about 4 cents per download. It's really sad. But what's the alternative? You know, is there an alternative? if you're signed to a major record label, apparently there isn't. You just got to kind of suck it up and deal with it. Not everybody's Trent Reznor. Not everybody's willing to take that chance to say, well, we're going to do it on our own merit without a label. A lot of people rely on a label. You have artists like Metallica who rely on a label because that's the only way they have these spectacular stage shows with the 50,000 Marshall amps up on the stage and the six trucks of lights and riggings and roadies. The label's fronting all that money for the tour, and then they hope to recoup their money from the tour, and then the band gets any proceeds above the initial costs. So it's a real sticky situation to be in. You're never going to see Perimeter of the Void on this incredible world tour with all these light shows and everything because we don't have label backing. At the same time, we can charge what we want when we put our music up online, and it doesn't bother us. But we're never going to get that type of exposure that a big label can give you. So I don't know. I mean, Kyle, let me put it in terms that would probably, you know, make a lot more sense to you. If you were told when you got your agent that anything through your agent, she was going to get 70% of the royalties of, but she was going to get you on these much higher profile projects, would you sign a deal like that?
Ooh.
Yeah, we could have you. Yeah, I mean, you could be like the announcer for the Tonight Show, but she's going to take 70% off the top. I mean, is it worth having such a high profile gig if you're not seeing the revenue that you would have got normally?
Well, it depends how much that gig pays. I'd have to ask Wally Wingard, since he voices the Jay Leno show, and then Leno is going back to the Tonight Show. So I wonder if Wally's out of a job.
Well, you know, they're talking about a pretty decent severance package, so I'm sure he's happy either way.
I'm thinking. That's quite a cluster F to think about there. A lot of people will you know, cut corners and kind of screw themselves over to, you know, we call it paying our dues to get to those higher caliber projects and this, that, and the other. So, God, if I could record on Futurama with Billy West and Maurice LaMarche and all that stuff, but not make as much as they do because my agent's getting 70% of the cut, yeah, I'd probably do it just because I want to do that job so friggin' bad.
I mean, I admit it's a little bit different when you're talking about a musician because musicians certainly have a different level of interactivity with their fan base than a voice actor does. Voice actors are primarily anonymous entities for the most part. When you're out in public, people don't necessarily know who you are. They may know your voice, but they don't know you. As musicians, it's different because you rely not only in recording and selling your music, but also going on tour and interacting with your fans. So I understand it's kind of an unfair comparison, but when you look at the amount of money that the record label's taking from these deals, that should rightfully be going into the pockets of the artists. And I understand the record label is doing a lot for the artists. It's giving them an opportunity just to be there. But it's so skewed. I personally don't know how I feel about it. I don't know how I would feel remaining indie and making next to nothing, or going with a major label, having my stuff all over the place, incredibly accessible, having some advertising to back it up, and get 4 cents a download, but get 200,000 downloads a month. That's kind of the caveat. I'm sure there are artists that are truly banking being in iTunes. I mean, you get a lot of the Beatles catalog on there, and you know it's one of the most protected properties out there musically. So in order for them to ink a deal with iTunes, you know they're banking on it. So I guess in volume it pays off, but in comparison to what the labels are raking in, it's really sad.
And bands can't really make their money with physical media anymore. And that's why you're kind of forced into digital distribution with iTunes or CD Baby or whatnot, just because, or the Amazon, just because of that name recognition. It's like, well, I'll just do it because everyone else does it. And yeah, I guess I'll go with price fixing because people expect a 99-cent download. They may look askew at something that says 49 cents. It's like, well, what? Is this a crappy song?
And you know, and you just kicked me squarely in the nuts because I had to look at that argument the same way. And the EBE Records catalog, Perimeter of the Void and Zero Rental stuff, it's going to be available on Amazon. And it's different. It's really different. With EBE Records, the artist sets the price. The label just takes enough of a percentage to keep the server up and running. I mean, it's really minimal, and the artist keeps the majority of the purchase price. But then you look at legitimacy and credibility at a place like Amazon. And for me, yeah, I admit I'm biased because I'm a G1 fan. I didn't go the Apple route with the iPhone. I have a G1. I really like supporting the Android network. And the Android network's default music shop is Amazon. And you know, you got like 16 Android devices out there now, and Amazon's already preloaded up on there, and it's credible. It's legitimate. People know the name Amazon. They know what they stand for. So to have the stuff on there, to have them set the price, Amazon sets the price of the sale, and they give you a flat rate on royalties per sale, which pales in comparison to EB Records. And this isn't a big commercial for EB Records. I'm just using it as a real-life example of the comparison of having that big name backing you up. You know, you go to Amazon, you know you've got this incredible support squad behind it. You've got money-back guarantees. You get this, you get that. You get uptime, you get secure transfers. Yeah, for me, I guess it's kind of worth it to say, go ahead and set the price. Go ahead and set the flat rate commission rate, because I'm dealing with a well-known, credible entity.
But it gets it out there. Amazon is a huge name. A lot of people go to it. It may not be as big as iTunes, but it's out there. It's legitimate, and it's the future. But you know, your average consumer is not really thinking in terms of, well, how much is the artist getting? You know, the consumer may just be going, well, how do I get this band? How do I try this band? Where do I go? Oh, their website. Okay, awesome. I'll download it. And the link takes you to Amazon. Or in your case, you just are right there, EBE Records. It's like the consumer just wants the music. And they're not really, you know, deconstructing. You know, not everyone. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of fans that do. But in general, people just are music consumers. You know, they just want the music. Whether they're going to download it illegally or pay 99 cents or 49 cents or whatever.
I had my microphone muted, but I was laughing out loud when you said, I don't think people know, or I'm paraphrasing, know or even really care how much the artist is getting paid when you download their music, because piracy is so rampant. You know, obviously, a lot of people don't care how much the artist is getting compensated. If you want it, you're going to get it. And if 99 cents sounds like too much for you, you know, you're going to find a way to get it. So it's kind of a sad state of affairs all around. But, I've got to go back with my argument with when you're dealing with a reputable company like Amazon or iTunes. Yeah, I guess you're kind of getting dicked in how much money you're getting in revenue, but the sheer exposure that you wouldn't have had otherwise, it may be worth it financially. What I don't like about iTunes is it's almost impossible for an independent artist to get their stuff up on there. Amazon, I really have to applaud, because almost anybody can get their stuff up on Amazon. It takes a while. It takes 2 or 3 weeks for them to go ahead and process everything, because you're not one of the big boys. But you know, it's kind of a small thing to suffer in comparison. iTunes, on the other hand, they primarily deal with people who broker music. If you want to join a company like CD Baby or TuneCore and pay $22.95 to have them upload your album to iTunes, you can do that. But my argument's always been, why pay to get your stuff up there when the only people that are going to download the stuff are the people that are familiar with your music? I know you download music on iTunes, Kyle, and I don't think you randomly download artists you've never heard of before. You know, nobody goes blind and says, hey, I'm going to go buy, you know, 3 songs from Perm of the Void to see what it's like. Only people who know Perm of the Void are going to go buy Perm of the Void. So that's always been my argument with the indie bands. Why are you paying money to get up on iTunes? People don't even know about you on iTunes. Put this shit up on your site, charge what you want for it, keep all the money. But it's just this thing, I guess, this rite of passage to say, ooh, we're on iTunes.
Yeah. I could have sworn that, you know, we talked about Johnny Young Bosch before. He's another voice actor from anime and video games and stuff, and he's big on promoting his band iShine lately. I think that iShine is now on iTunes. I don't know if he made a decision to change his distribution for his band, which is indie, or if he at some point just submitted to Apple and they just recently decided to process the paperwork, you know, much like app developers. They don't know. It's, you know, who knows? It's like, we're going to spend all this money and make all this product and this blood, sweat, and tears, and we're going to wait for approval, and it may or may not stick. Like, oh, crap, that kind of sucks. But meantime, yeah, you can go with Amazon and have all these other means to get it out there. And Amazon's. You bend over and take it up the tuchus, I guess, with iTunes in terms of artist profitability.
And Amazon is just more artist friendly. I mean, the criteria to get your stuff on Amazon is absolutely minimal, spare bones compared to Apple. Apple has this entire contractual process that you have to go through. And then this is the real kicker with iTunes, is you have to use their proprietary software to convert all of your files to have them upload them. And that's always been my biggest pitch with Apple, is everything is so proprietary, where they're putting in that DRM and they're putting in certain rights managements that keeps it for them and just for them. And I'm not dealing with that with Amazon. Amazon's like, hey, give us your MP3s. It's great. You know, if I want to put unprotected MP3s up there for people to download, not a problem. Apple has to get their fingers into it, even right down to the indie artist saying, well, if it's going to be on our thing, you need to use our software and convert all of those files to this different proprietary standard. That is pretty scary to me. I mean, that alone is, I don't care if I could make 200,000 downloads a month on iTunes. It's a big artist compromise.
Yeah, it is. Although I think the DRM thing got removed, right? On iTunes, there's no more DRM. I think that was a compromise that the labels came to or something.
I know that you still have to go through their proprietary file changing process. I could argue about Apple for another 90 minutes. because I really like I love Android. You know, Android is it's open source. People can develop the platform, and they're not contractually bound to promote those types of services. And I like that degree of saturation. I think you're always going to have the Apple purists who are going to buy the iPhones regardless of all the proprietary software and hardware, and being stuck with only using iTunes and stuff. But because Android is out there en masse, again, 16 phones compared to Apple's one, it seems kind of irrelevant right now, but have the same conversation a year or two from now, I think you're going to see a lot of market saturation with Android. And Apple really has to get off this proprietary thing, because it's not conducive to artists and it's not conducive to the customers to do that. So I don't know, maybe we'll see some pressure for them to change. But because they beat everybody to the punch, because they get their music service out there and it was legitimate and credible, and they said, look at us, and it became so incredibly established, it's still going to be the beacon. And anytime you're a musician or a fan of music, when you think digital music, you think iTunes automatically. They totally succeeded with that, their task in making it the firmly entrenched means to legitimately buy music online. And it's going to be an uphill battle for everybody else.
Well said. Thank you to everyone in our illustrious chat room during our live stream on StickCam, Anime Wolf, Axum White, Dark Death, Deadly Lufa, Evan, Jeff, Kamina, Kiki, Miss November, Fanto, Queen Lol, Wielding the Banhammer, Raizudo, Saiyan Angel, Speedy D, and anyone else we missed during the show. Thanks to our engineer, Mark. And we actually have some new end credits to end the show with. Mariana is going to tell us all the various ways you can find the Big Ball Broadcast on the interweb. So until next time, this is Kyle Hebert.
And this is Otherworld Steve.
See ya!
Check out the BigBaldBroadcast.com, the central hub for all the geeky news that you can use. There you can listen to new episodes, go back through the archives, and view our latest Twitter news. You can send your mail and MP3 comments to mail@thebigballsbroadcast.com. Subscribe now via iTunes, Zoom Marketplace, or your favorite RSS aggregator to have episodes downloaded automatically. Donations are graciously accepted and appreciated. Music provided by DJ Unicron and Zero Reynolds.